Hi, everyone. I'm Jennifer Vine, President and CEO of the Education Foundation of Sarasota County, and your host for Education Conversations, a discussion forum to share innovative and relevant thoughts, research, and ideas on education today. In today's podcast, we will explore ways to help prepare students to thrive. Welcome to this episode of Education Conversations, Well-Being Through Resiliency. Amid the current mental health crisis affecting students at all grade levels in 2022, the Florida Department of Education, which we're going to be calling as the FDOE, shifted its focus to building resiliency skills. In 2023, the FDOE began providing a resiliency toolkit that promotes classroom instruction of traits and skills such as perseverance, critical thinking, personal responsibility, and empathy. And also, in addition to ensuring more teachers receive student mental health awareness training, the FDOE now requires 5 hours of classroom resiliency instruction. With this increased focus on resiliency and with the release of the toolkit, it's a really opportune time for us to ask, what does resiliency really mean? Why is it important to build these skills? And how does it really help students? We want to know, how can we best serve students and teachers so that they can become more resilient and find well-being in an increasingly uncertain world? And today I'm really excited to explore these questions with someone that I've had the opportunity to get to know over the past few years, and that is Dr. Nathaniel Vonder Ems, an associate professor in the School of Psychology at the University of South Florida. We all like to call him Nate, and I think you'll enjoy hearing and learning from Nate as he has extensive experience in school psychology, both as a practitioner and on the policy side, which has been really helpful guiding the FDOE as a valued partner with them. He's also the co-director of the School Mental Health Collaborative, where he helps school districts across the country access evidence-based, high-quality resources that can be used to best meet the needs of students. He has helped develop and employ screening tools to determine student mental health needs and the efficacy of practices and policy. And through the Mental Health Collaborative, he has partnered with the FDOE to help define resiliency, create the resiliency toolkit, and develop the curriculum. So he has just a plethora of information and background, so I can't imagine us not learning a lot of things that are really pertinent to this conversation. So Nate, welcome to Education Conversations.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jennifer. I'm really excited to be here.
I am too, and I'm really excited to learn from you. And I want to start off first just to kind of ground the conversation as to how you entered into this field. And so I understand that you had started your work as a school psychologist at a high school, Hamilton High School, I think. There's a little bit of background there in Ohio where maybe President George Bush signed the No Child Left Behind bill, which that just takes you back to the time when all of that was happening. So what were you seeing back then when you were in the high schools, and how does that apply to what you're seeing today?
I've been involved in education for really all of my life. I'm a third generation educator. I'm a second generation school psychologist. And so being an educator has been something that's so core to my values. So in my early career as a school psychologist working in Southwest Ohio, I also worked as a school psychologist in mid-Michigan. One of the biggest challenges that we saw was that there were a number of families that might not have had access to really high quality services and supports in the schools at that time. And I think that was reflective of the broader kind of field of education, certainly with, you referenced No Child Left Behind, a landmark education bill that really brought forth us educational policy and really test-based accountability for the first time, and how the perception of that shifted at the very place it was signed. So every day when I was walking into that school, what once was a really point of pride, like this is where it started, really shifted into, hey, all of these really big federal efforts to improve schools didn't necessarily pan out the way that they thought they were. And there are still some very real challenges for the communities that we serve.
And where does that tie into the mental health challenges that we're seeing in students? Where's the connection between mental health well-being and educational attainment and success?
So I think before we talk about this, it really might make sense for just a minute to talk about what is mental health. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes when we talk about mental health, the first thing that people think of is mental illness. Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about mental health, just like physical health, it encompasses a number of things. both needs, right? Physical symptoms or mental health symptoms, things like anxiety, stress, withdrawal. But it also includes mental health strengths, things like social coping, adaptability to change. So just like we're promoting physical health, we also need to promote the mental health of everyone. And so when we talk about mental health, it's not mental illness, but mm-hmm. rather mental health. I work in a college of education at the University of South Florida. I don't know if I have to give a disclaimer that all opinions are my own.
Right.
but in our college of education, right, we train high-quality teachers to do high-quality instructional practice, which leads to academic achievement,
mm-hmm.
right? Well, if it were that simple, as a school psychologist, I wouldn't have a job. We often know, of course, that it's much more complex and complicated than that. We're dealing with kids here, after all. And so if we're not meeting their mental health needs, you can have a really great teacher doing really great high-quality instructional practices. You're not going to see that academic gain.
Mm-hmm.
There's no academic half of a kid and a mental health half of a kid. It's a whole child. So without addressing those kinds of needs, all of your academic efforts, all of your test-based accountability mm-hmm. practices, without those supports, just quite frankly, are not going to be effective. And we've seen that borne out both in the research as well as practice for many decades now.
That's really insightful. And I love your approach of defining mental health as a strengths-based place. I think that is a reminder for many of our listeners to really look at the proactive development of in children as opposed to just trying to correct any of the deficiencies or struggles that they may be having. We've heard a lot of conversation in our community, in the state, and the nation about just how children are developing, whether we call it child development, emotional intelligence, if we want to call it social emotional learning, or the latest phrase that we're using is resiliency. If we were to peel the onion back on that, because I think we need to get beyond the word and talk about what's defining all of that. What are those common threads, and how would you respond to the supposition of all these varying word choices around developing mental health in children?
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, I come from a family of educators, so we have quite some lively Thanksgiving conversations when we're talking about acronym soup, right? Many fields, of course, have this, but I think schools in particular, the jargon that we use, the acronyms that we use, often doesn't lend itself to real clear definitions of practice mm-hmm. that are important to parents. And I think that's what we're really talking about here, is what is a parent perception of the services that their kids need and what's happening in schools? So let's strip away all the labels. Mm-hmm. Let's strip away the definitions. Mm-hmm. And when we think about the very skills, the discrete, definable, measurable skills that kids need, things like social awareness, self-management, responsible decision-making, relationship skills, you ask any parent, and they've done this. The Fordham Institute recently published a study where they asked a huge group of parents from all across the spectrum of backgrounds and political affiliations. When you focus on that skill, universally parents want this, and they want this in schools for their kids, right? Labels aside, the skills that cut across, whether we call this resilience, character education, social emotional learning, mental health even, mm-hmm. right? When we focus on those skills, parents universally say, we want this for our kids, we recognize its importance, and our kids need this to be able to succeed both academically as well as productive global citizens.
That's great. And why is it that parents want to see this? Give me a real world example of if a student were to learn social awareness, why does that matter?
And as a parent and a researcher, I first approach any kind of practice when I'm working with a school or a parent or an educator. If I wouldn't do this with my own kid, I wouldn't want this any other parent to do it with theirs. And so I think of it as a very personal thing for me. And I've seen this firsthand. I'm a parent of a second and sixth grader. And when I've seen my own children come home, especially after the last couple of years that we've all kind of experienced as a nation and as the world more generally, there are some very clear needs within my own children. And this is children of two psychologists. And so when we're honing in on kind of some of their needs and we hear from the school, yeah, they're doing great academically, but we also see the stress and distress, really, when they come home from school and trying to manage the many demands on their time and the many demands on what they need to do for organization and for performance. there is a very real cost to that, that as a parent, the only thing you want for your child is that they're happy, healthy, and engaged in an academic environment. And so, yes, the grades matter, but we saw firsthand the very real struggle of our kids as they've dealt with some of the environmental challenges that we've all experienced the last couple of years. And so when we know we can treat the symptom, right? We can treat the stress, we can treat the challenges that a student might experience, but we can also give them some very real practical skills that'll prevent that from happening. And ultimately, we know across all disciplines that prevention is a much more effective and efficient way to support the development of kids.
That's good. So it's basically using these opportunities to develop the competencies of self-regulation and coping and being able to moderate themselves and handle the stressors that happen in life. Mm-hmm. Can you give me another like real world beyond like the classroom environment? So if I've learned how to self-regulate, I can work within my world, but outside the classroom, now where do these competencies serve me well? Why do I need to know these things in the real world? Can you give me an example of that?
Yeah, absolutely. Every single industry, whether it's education, manufacturing, or whatnot, recognizes that a healthy, well employee is going to have a productive environment for them to be able to do their job. Every single industry does that. Why would education be any different mm-hmm. when we're supporting our kids? And so I don't have one example. I've got 1,000 examples. Whether our listeners are working in law and medicine or in retail, if they approach their work day well, if they approach their work day feeling supported by their environment, they're going to do a good job at that job. Mm-hmm. And just the same thing for our kids. If they feel supported, if they have those skills that they're developing that we know they'll need later in life, they'll do well. And so I think it's not something that is unique to education. I think it's something that is deeply embedded in all humans.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think it's so important that we continue this conversation because it really does demonstrate how the whole child development is so important. Then it goes beyond just the academic attainment. So I think that's really important. So moving into a little bit of a different angle, you have helped develop some screening assessments that are widely used in states across the country. What's the data showing us today?
So when we think about how do we identify students in need of support, even in schools that are implementing preventative systems of care, almost 80% of those schools are relying on something called an office discipline referral, expulsion, suspensions, things like that. And that's a real problem because these are reactive methods, mm-hmm. right? It's a wait to fail method where a child will exhibit a certain level of need, often significant, often externalizing, which will then culminate, not necessarily accurately or efficiently, in some kind of discipline referral. Rather, some of my work has really focused on preventative or proactive types of measurements that I think of this as taking the temperature before surgery is needed, mm-hmm. right? Where are kids at where we can facilitate early intervention services that we can really prevent these long-term challenges from happening? And so when we look at these tools, it's looking, again, consistent with our conceptualization of mental health, mm-hmm. not mental illness. We're looking at both strengths as well as needs of that child. And how we've seen some of these data over time, my work has, the screening tools that we've worked with are in all 50 states. Last year it was completed nearly 10 million times.
Wow.
So we have a lot of data across the United States, and what we've seen is a significant uptick in the mental health needs of our kids, right? This is not a Florida thing. This is not a Sarasota thing. This is a United States thing. The needs are significant. The needs cut across all backgrounds and demographics of the families and children that we serve.
And are you also able to interpret that data as to unpacking why we're seeing the uptick? I mean, I think a lot of people are saying, oh, the pandemic, and that certainly has created a whole level of upheaval and chaos and disorder. But what other things would you say are attributed to the increase?
Yeah, I don't want to dismiss or diminish at all the influence of the pandemic, but the mental health needs of kids are not new. Mm-hmm. Maybe our recognition of them are newer, but certainly as we think about student voice mm-hmm. and getting their student perspective of this, I absolutely believe that we've had undergone a fundamental shift in how we're conceptualizing mental health. There's no going back to this kind of hush-hush stigma there's certainly some stigma around mental health, but this new generation of students and youth, as we think about their needs and being vocal about their needs, it's not an optional thing. It's so deeply embedded in how we're developing our academic outcomes for our kids that we have to be able to address these. And so unique contributors to that, certainly there are things like the pandemic and the challenges with kind of social media. There are challenges with kind of just everyday life of being a kid. And again, a lot of those things aren't new, but it further reinforces the need that we need to be able to give kids the skills to be able to meet the unique challenges. And challenges, again, that we might not even know 5 or 10 years from now.
Right.
And so we're preparing our kids for a dynamic, changing environment, giving them the tools that they need to succeed in this environment.
That's terrific. So in addition to your work with the University of South Florida, you co-direct, as I mentioned before, the School Mental Health Collaborative. Can you tell me what about the collaborative is so important for you to be a part of it?
Yeah, for me, when we talk about the School Mental Health Collaborative, it really was born out of a challenge that many of us within the collaborative were experiencing as individuals, in that we think of this as like the Google or Pinterest problem. And I'll explain a little bit more. So when you're asking an educator kind of, you know, where are they getting some of their ideas for classroom management? Or you're asking a school principal, hey, have you heard about the most recent blank, blank, blank? Where are they getting this information? By and large, it's not the U.S. Department of Education's What Works Clearinghouse. Oftentimes, it's a quick Google, right? Or more often than not, it's a recommendation from a friend or a trusted colleague. And so what we're trying to do with the School Mental Health Collaborative is really fill this research to practice gap. Mm-hmm. We might be developing really high quality tools, but if no one is using them, are we really developing high quality tools? This is kind of the tree falling in the forest here. Mm-hmm. And so as a collaborative, we are deeply committed in our mission to be able to increase the access that schools might have to really high quality, evidence-based, oftentimes free tools that will put them in a level playing field that when they make these really critical choices, and I've yet to meet that school that has, you know what, I've got so much time and money, I just don't know what to do, right? That school doesn't exist as far as I know. And so if schools are strapped for money, if they're strapped for time, it is up to us as a collaborative, as researchers, to give them those high quality tools that are going to work, and they're going to work well, and they're going to be efficient.
That's fantastic. And so for any of the teachers that are listening in on this conversation, where would you direct them to find these free resources? Because I'm sure they would enjoy that over anything they found on Pinterest. So where would you direct them?
Sure. So our website is smhcollaborative.org. We are a 3-university collaborative, both here at the University of South Florida, along with our colleagues at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, the University of California, Santa Barbara. We're adding additional university collaborations across the United States. And it's a real commitment, a shared commitment amongst a group of individuals to not only produce high quality work, but work that's accessible to schools that they can download, they can use for free. And we're always there to support from a technical assistance lens about how to implement that for their schools.
That is really outstanding. And so I think your mental health collaborative certainly has some street cred, considering that the Florida Department of Education really reached out to you all to help building that resiliency toolkit. And so moving in that direction, how have you all worked with the FDOE in defining resiliency? What is that?
Yeah, so when we've been able to work with the Florida Department of Education, it's been a phenomenal opportunity to have impact at the state level. Florida has been a real leader in this space in terms of kind of how we're addressing resiliency and meeting the kids' needs. Certainly after the horrific tragedy of Parkland, the State Department of Education and as well as state legislators kind of got together and said, hey, what are we going to do differently here to meet the kids' needs? And we've seen that certainly evolve over time, and the resiliency is kind of what we're conceptualizing this as now. But if you look at the core characteristics of resilience, if we're thinking about you know, how to be an effective citizen, how do you mentor students, how do you self-regulate, how do you self-manage, how do you engage with your peers in an appropriate and productive way? You know, these are the kind of things that are core to being a resilient person. Again, focusing on those proactive, strength-based skills that'll allow you to succeed no matter what the environment will throw at you. And so I think the resilience education opportunity and the resilience assessment that we were working on as well is a real opportunity for schools to kind of get a look at or a peek of where their students are at, but also using that information to say, all right, here's where we can really supplement those skills from a curricular perspective and really kind of build those skills and help those kids become more resilient in the future.
That's terrific. And so here in Sarasota County Schools, the student services team has used the resiliency toolkit to create lessons that are aligned to the grade levels and helping students develop the resiliency skills and character education in grades 6 through 12. School counselors are also teaching these things. How do traits like these, like coping, grit, gratitude, help students navigate uncertain times?
Yeah, when we approach any kind of challenging circumstance or situation, oftentimes we rely on either the skills that we've had or the past experiences we've had. And being able to teach a student an explicit, evidence-based, discrete, measurable skill gives kids an equal or level platform or playing field to be able to be successful in that particular situation. So it's not necessarily relying on their own kind of personal experience, not relying on their maybe family background, but rather if all kids have these skills, we are ensuring this base or foundational level of skill set that we would expect them to be successful or navigating some of these really difficult or challenging experiences. And so when we focus on things like grit and building up a resilience to a challenging situation, if we're focusing on kind of self-awareness to understanding kind of when you're stressed or coping with that stress, things that we all do as adults across all industries, we're being very explicit with how we're teaching that with our kids.
So would you say that, like for a parent that may be listening, just trying to get a, you know, peek into the classroom as this is playing out and being taught, is it being like, okay, class, we're going to learn about grit today. And so walk us through, like, is it where it is helping the student gain a deeper understanding and reflection of where they may be, where they need to go, how they can develop it so they're thinking a little bit more critically for themselves? Or are you putting a worksheet in front of them and just saying, hey, you know, sign this, check the box, and let's call it a day? How would you kind of walk us through that classroom, you know, explicit instruction for the non-educators that are listening?
Yeah, and certainly explicit instruction is the key word there. And that this isn't a worksheet, this isn't a YouTube video.
Yeah.
Rather, it's helping kids, and again, all kids are going to be at developmental levels. They're at different developmental levels. This is very different for a second grader versus a senior in high school. But not only are we providing definitions of these concepts and giving examples and non-examples, but we're putting this into practice. It's one thing to kind of learn a skill from kind of a passive acquisition from an instructional standpoint. It's another thing to be able to practice it and then receiving coaching and feedback on how to improve that skill over time. And so that's the real key differentiation here, is that when we're talking about these kinds of skills, they don't need to be kind of one-off. They don't need to be a separate thing. These are deeply embedded throughout all the academic curriculum. Stress management, and before I did work in this area, I did a lot of research in the area of test anxiety. You can have a really great academic background, but if you're not able to manage your stress and emotion in a high-stakes environment, you won't ever be able to demonstrate that academic performance and quite frankly, your knowledge in a particular area. And so how we not only learn these kinds of skills like stress management, but then practice them in very real world situations that kids will need for their further educational advancement. That's what we're trying to do here.
How does the developing these resiliency skills tie in with mindset? I'm just kind of curious because it does make me also think, and that may be a different topic, but it does make me think about the growth mindset and fixed mindset and all of the research that's for years been around for that. Is there a intersection on that?
Yeah, I think so. When we're talking about growth mindset versus fixed mindset, resilience, things like character education, I mean, there's a lot of different kinds of terminology. And without kind of getting into a really deep dive into factor analysis, which might not necessarily be the hot topic for your intended audience, there's a lot of overlap in our Venn diagram when we're talking about the same kind of skills. So regardless of kind of what we're talking about it, from both a researcher as well as a parent lens, I really like to hone in and focus on what is the actual and specific skills we're learning? How are those directly tied to those really important both social and academic outcomes that we're trying to achieve? And so things like growth mindset might be another way to address or give kids skills to approach a challenging situation, right? Something that they're not necessarily focused on, something that's outside of their control, or they might not be focused on something that, hey, I'm X, I can never be Y. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But rather, like, this is a new situation for me. I rise up to meet this challenge, kind of this approaching mindset. Those are the same, there's some very similar skills that we're trying to teach you within resilience.
Yeah, I think there's definitely some intersection. I appreciate you kind of illuminating on that. So as the Education Foundation, we've also been a small piece in the global, you know, effort from the FDOE out through the state of building resiliency, as we've been kind of participating through resiliency through community. And so as you see kind of as it's being embedded in all the different places and spaces, as you described, it's not just a standalone one-off. It needs to be kind of everywhere and embedded. What would you say to our community at large? You know, of what's the role that community members can play in helping to develop those very same skills and traits in the students today?
Yeah, I think the very nature of a public school system is both one serving of the community, but also reflecting of the community. And so as something that serves those kind of communities, I think the community is absolutely essential in informing those kinds of conversations around, you know, where are your graduates going? Where are the kids that leave that school system? How are they integrating into the community? And oftentimes we see firsthand both the successes and challenges that kids experience outside of the school system, right, when they're not within that school. So I think the community plays a really important role. Community leaders, foundation leaders such as yourselves, I think there's a very real opportunity to shape this kind of discussion, shape this narrative. Ideally, again, I come from this from a research lens, that we need to have evidence, we need to have data for what we do, right? There's just not enough hours in the school day. There's just not enough time. There's not enough money to be able to do ineffective practices. And so from a community standpoint, I think there's a very real and critical need for leadership to step into this space and inform this debate with high quality practices that are accessible when many schools just quite frankly don't have access to that.
Mm. So you've been providing additional resources into the schools to help them flourish with the kids is an important component. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
It's a non-negotiable and an essential component.
Thank you for sharing that. I think that's almost a rallying cry, to be honest with you, to our community at large, of really being able to see point and center that if we really want to have a thriving community, then we need to have our students thriving. If we need to have our students thriving, they need the resources and supports to help enable them to do that. And I think these are certainly all appropriate topics for us to be advancing in our community, for sure. So thank you for that. Are there organizations or any other online resources that either students and families can resource, you know, can access rather, or even teachers could access to help them, you know, strengthen their own efficacy in teaching these skills?
One, from a parent lens, it's really important for folks like me and for foundations and things like that, is to really work to increase that access. You know, there's a billion different kinds of websites out there, so it's kind of the black hole of Google right there. So I think it's really important to insert data-based effective conversations and get those in front and center to parents as an active process, right? We can't assume that all parents would have that same level of knowledge or maybe able to discern what's a high-quality resource versus what's not. So I think the importance of not only developing, but disseminating really high quality resources is just of critical and absolute importance for community leaders, for foundations, for research partnerships and things like that. Kind of where they go to those resources, I think there's some really exciting and potentially interesting opportunities, both at the state level as well as national level, partnering with kind of our state government as well as some national foundations. I'm part of a group that was recently awarded a $10 million grant from the U.S. Department of Education, along with three other universities, and we provide technical assistance to 300 grantees, several hundred million dollars of school-based mental health services. And so we're working across the country to develop the workforce to be able to develop high-quality resources for schools, which we hope to extend into the parent domain. So we're really excited.
Wow, that's very exciting.
It's very exciting. This is a project that just launched October 1st. You're going to hear a lot more about it
year. Congratulations to you. That's fantastic.
Yeah. And thank you. And that's something that I've just been fortunate to be a part of, an incredible team of talented individuals to be able to do that. In terms of the teacher end of things, oftentimes I tell my graduate students that, you know, certainly we're training you in high quality evidence-based practices, but I hope 10 years from now, at least a portion of those would become outdated, right? That's a sign of a healthy, growing, evolving field. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing with education. And so when we're talking about how do we support our teachers, a lot of it has to focus on professional development, right? As the science has changed and is rapidly evolving, and we want to know kind of like what's kind of cutting edge in terms of how are we supporting our youth, both academically as well as in the emotional and mental health domains, we need to be able to provide high quality professional development to our educators. One that explicitly recognizes that no educator is sitting around and saying, what am I going to do with 8 hours of my day for PD online, right? But rather, how are we meeting them where they're at skill-wise, and how do we make that directly applicable to their practice?
Well, that is fantastic. I'm excited to see what the future holds and where you're going, and I absolutely appreciate your lens to the professional learning of teachers, because the landscape is changing, the field is changing,
absolutely,
kids' needs are changing, and we always want to be on the proactive side and leading in that work as opposed to lagging. So your efforts are outstanding, so thank you for that. One final question is, and I mean, you've inspired me, so I can kind of surmise how you're going to answer this, but one final question is, being a parent, a psychologist, and a researcher that's all in this work, are you sitting on the spectrum, tilting towards hope, tilting towards despair? And that's almost like a gimme, but
sure.
Take that one for what it's worth.
Yeah, I'm in this field because I believe, some maybe sometimes naively, of the unending potential of the work that we do as educators. So this is something that, for as long as I can remember, I've been deeply committed to, both professionally and personally. And now I see it in the next generation with my own kids. And so I think being able to connect this work to and recognizing the true power of education as a transformative practice that can level the playing field and let all kids reach their potential, almost like No Child Left Behind. While aspirational, that's something that I hold very deeply to me as both a person and as a researcher, and more importantly, for me as a parent.
That is fantastic. That's probably why you're an great guest, because the Education Foundation of Sarasota County supports that premise, and we certainly are inspired because we too also believe that every child can reach their full potential and lean on the strengths that they have within them. And so thank you for your steadfast, longstanding service, and generationally, even to your parents, you know, who were educators themselves. Thanks for being a part of this podcast today. I've learned so much, and listeners, I hope you have learned too. Nate, shout out one last time for us, the Mental Health Collaborative website where they can find some resources.
Yeah, you can reach us at smhcollaborative.org. You can find us at the University of South Florida website, or my own USF email is natev@usf.edu. I'm happy to engage with parents, with educators. If there's something I can do to help improve your own outcomes for your kids, I'm always happy to do that.
Wow. That's a great invitation to all of our listeners to take advantage of. And if you also want to learn anything more about the Education Foundation or any of the resources that we have for students and teachers, you can find that on our website at edfoundationsrq.org. And so we definitely hope that people will get involved in this work and make sure that students stay front and center into all that we do, as they are our next generation. So, guys, thank you all so much for listening to today's podcast, and be sure to tune in to our other episodes of Education Conversations. For now, this is Jennifer Vine signing off for the Education Foundation of Sarasota County.